it's not just about knowing the process and having the skills. It's about your approach. And from the way that you describe it, your respect for other people, that you need to be able to truly believe and embrace the idea that a reasonable person can hold a different view. Hello, everyone, and welcome to the podcast of The Decision Lab, a socially conscious applied research firm that uses behavioral science to improve outcomes for all of society. My name is Brooke Strzok, research director at TDL, and I'll be your host for the discussion. My guest today is Roger Martin, former dean of the Rotman School of Business at the University of Toronto, author of over a dozen best-selling business books, and longtime strategy advisor to global brands such as Procter & Gamble, Lego, and Ford. In today's episode, we'll be talking about creating great choices, coming up with options that are better than the ideas already on the table. Roger, thanks for joining us.
Hey, it's a pleasure. It's great to be here. And I think you and I sound like we're interested in some of the same things. I'm always interested in models, how people, they should think about something. And I've sort of made it my career's work to explore when people have models that don't produce the outcomes that they were hoping for. I don't quibble with their outcomes that they're hoping for. I ask the question, is the model that you're using actually getting you that outcome, or is it actually not? And you think trying harder, doing more of it will get you the answer. And you refer to Creating Great Choices. That's a book about a model that says, well, if you have a really difficult choice, if you're a real tough guy or tough gal, you'll just knuckle down and make that hard, hard choice. And that's our model. My question is, might there be a better model? Might there be a model that says, you know what, maybe that's life's way of telling you you should do something different than make that difficult choice. So that's kind of what I do in life.
That's a great introduction. I think that concept of toughness is a great place to start. So leadership in a lot of public and private sector contexts seems to include three truths, which we hold to be self-evident. People hate compromise, people hate flip-flopping, and you can't please everyone. Those seem to be core ingredients to the model of making tough decisions. What kinds of decision dynamics do these mantras and others like them create within organizations, especially around these apparently either-or decisions?
I think it's in part behind some of the polarization that's gone on in politics, because people hate compromise. For what it's worth, I'm very sympathetic with the hate for compromise. It's sort of like, you don't get what you want, I don't get what I want, and we settle for something blah in between. So the idea that people should love compromise, I think, is sort of far-fetched. So the general view is, especially in the political realm, is then we have to fight as hard as we can to have our side win, even if it's 50.1% of the electorate saying so, at least we've prevailed. I think that just turns people into enemies. So other ideas are alien creatures that it would be better off if we could somehow destroy. It leads to all of those behaviors that you're seeing writ large out there. My view is what passes up is huge treasure troves of pieces or chunks of ideas that you could actually take from the opposing model and figure out how to create something that's better than either party contemplated. And then you don't have compromise. You don't have winners and losers, although you have winners, which is everyone. You don't have losers. That requires a different model. It says, my job is not to make sure my model trounces yours intellectually. I can out-argue you, or I can get more people behind me than you can get behind you. And so we overwhelm you. It says, those actually aren't my jobs. My job is a miner. I'm mining your model for all the nifty tidbits in it that could be integrated into a superior model.
Yeah, we'll dig into that better model a little later on. First, let's mine the problem a little deeper. It might be helpful to introduce an example here. So do you have some examples in mind of classic, seemingly either-or decisions where we do what it is that you've just described? So we arrange ourselves into camps for and against. We kind of quell any ideation or discussion of what other options might exist.
Well, since you're broadcasting from Canada, I'll give you a Canadian example, which is Bob Young, who's a Canadian who was the co-founder of Red Hat, which became the dominant and is still 26 years later, the dominant software company, in fact, sold to IBM for, I think, $30 or $40 billion. If you scroll back to 1995, there was this free software movement that had cropped up. The dominant software, of course, was Microsoft. operating system, in the operating system, Microsoft Windows. And it was classically proprietary software. They would sell you a copy of Windows 95 at that time for a couple hundred bucks and didn't give you the source code, so you could not modify it. And it had a license so that you could put it on your computer and nobody else's. And they had hit squads to go around and shoot anybody who gave it to anybody else. Well, not quite, but close. And the free software movement hated everything about that. They were taking Linux codes, compiling software packages. They had weird names like Yggdrasil, which was a Norse god, or Slackware, which was a bunch of slackers doing it. And they would sell a disk of this free software. And as Bob said, it wasn't free as in free beer. It's free as in you can do anything you want with it for like 15 or 20 bucks. So it was $200-$300 for proprietary and shrink-wrapped software that you'd sell out of your basement. And both sides kind of hated one another. The free software movement stood against what Microsoft was, the evil empire. Microsoft saw these guys as a threat to their business, and they were hackers that sold this crappy software that didn't have quality control and version control and all that kind of stuff. Bob is facing that. And the problem is that he stands against everything that Microsoft stands for. He said it's like selling a car with the hood welded shut so that you can't fix it when it needs to be fixed. But he looks at all the free software players and says, well, they're all like people in garages getting nowhere. And the only people who are using this software are other hackers, because you can't be a corporation and count on Slackware being able to take care of you. So you've got that either or choice. Am I free or am I proprietary? Bob Young, instead of saying, gosh, I have to choose one or the other, he said, I don't like either. And so what am I going to do? And he came to the insight that said, well, the only way that big corporations or corporations of any size are going to trust Linux-based free software is if they've got a big provider, because they have to make a bet on it, install servers that are based on that, et cetera. It's a big, big investment, and that company's got to be around and be trustworthy. And so we've got to become the biggest. And what we're going to do is, rather than make money selling software, we're going to make money servicing software. We're going to put Linux up on servers everywhere around the world for downloadable for free to become the dominant player, which they quickly did, 70% share of the market. Then they could go to corporations and say, you want the 70 share player to take care of you, we'll take care of you. And so he managed to build an extremely valuable company, legitimize Linux software. That was the legitimizing moment. So big companies started to use it, and the world's, I would argue, a better place for it. You've got a kind of a Red Hat Linux choice or a Microsoft choice in software for computers and servers. And there you go. It was not either or. I've got to come up with a better answer for it. And what we'd argue is that it comes from not saying, oh my God, I have proprietary free, because at that high level of abstraction, the label we put on it, like you're conservative, you're liberal, you're proprietary, you're free, that appear as though there is no common ground. If you look beneath it and say, well, how does that model work? How does this model work? Ooh, we could take that piece and put them together in a new way. You get a better model.
You see, you can start off with free software and end up owning the Hamilton Tiger Cats.
That is exactly the moral of this story.
Okay, so let's dig into that a little bit deeper. Let's focus now on the moment before this transformation of the idea, the development of the third way. Let's focus on that moment when all you see is these two monoliths that seem to be standing across from each other. So how do cognitive and social dynamics within organizations tend to reinforce that pattern of seeing the monoliths and not being able to get past it?
A bunch of these things are human. The human mind works, if you just want to say the absolutely basic thinking process. And this was something that a great, now late scholar named Chris Argyris talked about back in the 70s, was people have a ladder of inference in their mind. So you kind of make decisions. If we see a tiger over there, you know, we have to decide to run or fight or whatever. We have to observe what's around us and do something based on that. That's just the way life works. And what Chris said is that we start at the lowest level from data, what he called directly observable data. I see rustling in the grass over there. It might be a tiger. And then we add inferences to, I saw rustling in the grass. It might be a tiger. Oh, that's a problem, because I'm undefended, therefore I better try and sneak away before the tiger sees me. We come to a conclusion. We work our way up that ladder to a conclusion. So people are wired to do that. We're not wired to say, I saw rustling over there in the grass, I'm done here. You're wired to come to a conclusion. Those people and organizations who do what we've been describing, which is come to these sort of balkanized views, are just following their ladder of inference up to do the thing that they were designed evolutionarily or by some higher power to do. In some sense, what I'm saying is you have to be reflective about that ladder, and rather than just going vshht, because often once you get to the top of the ladder, you can't even remember how you got there. I'm sure you've had that experience where you just sort of know something and somebody says, well, why do you think that? You actually have to work really hard to reconstruct, you know, the pattern that got you there. And generally you can, but it's sort of extra work. Once you've got there, you've got there. So what I say is you got to be more reflective about that. I ask people to be reflective about their own model, to say, well, let's specify how that model works. And then I ask them to do a hard thing, which is when somebody's got a model that you think of as opposing your model, I want you to inquire into that and not ask the question like, boy, Brooke, that's a pretty stupid model. Could you explain how stupid that is, right? Which is actually generally what people are inclined to do with models that don't like. Why on earth do you believe that? You're not going to get anything out of that. Instead, say, Brooke, that is very cool. I want to understand that better. Tell me more about how that model works. What benefits does it produce for you, for your customer? Tell me more about that model. It's hard. A great example is the Toronto International Film Festival, Pierce Handling, turning it from the third best film festival in Canada to the most important film festival in the world. He loved the open community-oriented film festival that he inherited. He hated Cannes and everything it stood for, the elites defining tastes, excluding the average person from being able to see the movies that only the elite were allowed to see. But instead of saying, I am going to make sure that Toronto never gets to be like that evil Cannes, he very cleverly said, how the heck does Cannes actually work? How does it produce benefits for the city of Cannes and the south of France? How does it create benefits for the industry that it serves? How does it create benefits for the festival itself? How does that work? And on the basis of really deeply understanding something he didn't like at all, he figured out a model for the Toronto International Film Festival that made it the best. So the key is interrogating your own model and really understanding, and then doing the same to a model that you just don't love.
I like the way that you framed that. In opening the conversation, you talked about interrogating models, and you mentioned that you yourself try not to judge the outputs that people want from their models. Your main thing is really pushing on helping them to dig into the models themselves. That seems to come back around now with this story about the Toronto International Film Festival. Even looking at Cannes and saying, I don't value the outcomes that they value. The inference doesn't stand from that to there's nothing interesting that I can learn about how this model works.
Although I would say that's the inference that most people draw most of the time. Sadly, most people blind themselves to that. What he discovered in Cannes is, but Cannes, they get buzz that attracts the media that gets sponsorship to make it so we don't have to be hand to mouth begging for government money all the time. How could we get buzz, but not in a way that they do, which is to have an elite jury be voting on what's the Palme d'Or for the award for the best movie at the film festival. That gets everybody like, who's going to win? Who's going to win? Who's going to win? Exciting, exciting, exciting media buzz. How do we get that in a Toronto International Film Festival kind of way? And there's the insight then. It's sort of like, hold it. People have to pay for tickets at Toronto. They don't pay for tickets at Cannes. So that's not a real audience, actually. We have real audiences. Isn't it interesting that Toronto is both a big North American city that's kind of sort of like other big North American cities, and the US market is the biggest film market in the world. But what's emerging is the global market. It's now in totality bigger than the US market. It didn't used to be, it now is. And Toronto happens to be the most global city in the world. Over 50% of GTA people have a foreign passport. 20% is the biggest for any US city in New York. So it's unbelievably diverse from a geographic background of people. So what could we do that's consistent with our communitarianism and takes advantage of that? The People's Choice Award. So suddenly your award is a predictor of massive successes, and it becomes the most important. It's not the most famous. The Palme d'Or is still probably the most famous, but there's no question whatsoever that the most important film festival award in the world is the People's Choice Award in Toronto. You figured out how that model worked and got a big aha that you could apply to yours. And the great thing about it, why I often use it as an example, is if you ask the question, how community-oriented and inclusive was Toronto International Film Festival before that insight? The answer is index of 100. Is this a compromise? So we had to do something that would make it less community-oriented to get the thing we wanted. The answer brilliantly is no. It's you now tell people, not only can you go to any movie you want and buy tickets to see it, you now contribute to figuring out what the future Academy Award winner is likely to be. You just plain old Toronto Film Festival goer. So in some sense, it becomes, if anything, more inclusive than it was previously.
In characterizing the obstacles of business as usual, we move from not valuing the outcome that our opponents value to dismissing how their models work, for not learning from their models and therefore not building better models ourselves. And for years, you've been working on this concept of integrative thinking, mm-hmm. which is an alternative to just accepting this kind of polarized either or situation. Can you tell us about the steps in the process of integrative thinking?
One is to both accept the models as they are, and if anything, push them to even more extremes. So because sort of compromise is the note, oh, God, we've got to compromise, people sort of try and come up with sort of models that are similar. I say, no, push them to their extreme. So when we do things where like big corporation was saying, well, should we make all of our training centralized at corporate or regionalized? What should we do? And they're already thinking about what combination of these two things. I say, no. Okay, model A is the regions do nothing. There aren't training people in the regions, nothing. They do zero, nothing. Head office does everything. And then the other was, there is no corporate training function. It's all entirely up to the regions. It's not coordinated on. They're like, but we would never do either. And I say, I don't care. The plan is not to get one of these things. The plan is to get a better answer. So one is push the models to their extreme. Then it's to do this. How does each model work? Film festival. How does it work for who are the important stakeholders? And there tend to be three, as it turns out. Like most of these things are just empirical. When we've done hundreds and hundreds of these, it turns out three. There it's, how does it work for the community? How does it work for the industry? And how does it work for your entity, the festival itself? And do that for Toronto, the film industry, and TIFF. And then you do it for Cannes, the city of Cannes, the festival Cannes, and the industry there. And just lay out how it works, the mechanisms by which it works. Now, people get confused when I tell them, they say, what are the good things about it? No, it's not just that. You have to explain how it works. How does this model produce its outcome? And then you look, the step three is you look for integrative pathways. What we found over time is that there are sort of three kinds of integrations. One is what we call the hidden gem, where you throw away a bunch of the conflict. Bob Young did that. He said, ooh, the conflict comes from selling software that you have to make proprietary to be able to invest in it. Let's get out of the business of selling software. Let's talk about the services. So he threw away most of the models that created the conflict. So that's one integrative pathway. So we say explore hidden gems. What could you toss away to build from a piece of each model? So he built service. Service is a big part of the Microsoft model. I'm going to pick service out of there. It's a nice, big, high-margin business. And I'm going to pick the customizability of it from the other model. And everything else we throw it and we start from scratch. Double down is how can you push, it's a second path, how can you push harder on one model to get the benefits of the other? So you pushed on inclusivity with the People's Choice Award to get the buzz that you wanted from the other model. And the other one we've identified and see often is something called decomposition, where you say, oh, actually, we could apply the one model to part of the problem and the other model to the other part of the problem. It isn't one problem. It is two problems. An example is Connect and Develop, P&G's famous move into new way of doing kind of innovation, where insight was innovation isn't innovation. Innovation is invention and commercialization. And we'll use a different model for invention, getting 50% of our inventions from the outside, Connect and Develop, and double the pipeline through our commercialization machine, which is a very efficient, high volume machine. So the third is to say, let's try, can we find a hidden gem? Can we find double down? Can we find a decomposition? Usually you can find one. In fact, I haven't had a situation yet where we can't find one of those. And then you got to go and test it out. What I say is anything that's new and innovative, you need to test out, try it in little ways to see whether it works.
That's great. I really like the cognitive delay that you're pushing there, especially around pushing the models to the extremes. Even that pushback that you noted anecdotally that people are saying, we're not actually interested in a model that is as extreme as we're articulating here. What I sense there intuitively is just this pushback against delaying decisions. And there seems to be a bit of a kinship there with interest-based negotiation. I gather that you're familiar with the term.
That is trying to get beyond the position. The late Roger Fisher and Bruce Patton and Bill Urey were actually friends and colleagues of mine. So don't do that. Ask the question, what's behind? What are the real interests behind in order to be able to start to have something that is getting beyond the labels to what's in behind it?
Yeah, it seems to me that there's a bit of a kinship there, that an interest-based negotiation, as you articulated, the idea is if you've got two parties sitting down at the table and each one has already hammered out, this is what I want the final agreement to look like, you've already gone too far. You need to walk back and say, well, what is it that you actually, what are the priorities? What are the needs that need to be addressed by whatever final agreement is reached? What that final agreement looks like in order to fulfill those is, in theory, what the negotiation is supposed to be about. So to push on this kinship, it seems like what's going on with integrative thinking is to delay that idea that there's already a model in mind that we've chosen, and now it's just about getting people on board with the idea that this is the right one, and instead asking, what is it that we want to get out of these models, and especially, how do these models work? And going through that articulation process, as I was thinking about it and reading about it, it seems a little bit, integrative thinking is in some ways like interest-based negotiation with yourself.
There is a kinship. I'll tell you how far the kinship goes and where it stops, though I understand why. I just don't like the concept of negotiation. Integrative thinking is not negotiation. I don't want to have the view being that you and I have to negotiate with one another because we think differently. It's you and I have to create something magical together is more what I want. So that's why I don't, in my books about this opposable mind, the wonderful Jennifer Rial, The Creating Great Choices, why we don't explore that kinship is because I'm adverse to that aspect of negotiation. Now, that having been said, Roger, you know, Bill and Bruce would say the best kind of negotiators or people who facilitate these sessions are the ones who can come up with creative, kind of out of the box kind of solutions, getting to yes, right? It is sort of, we're disagreeing and our goal is to get these two parties to an agreement. That is not my goal. My goal is to come up with a breakthrough that makes everybody better off.
It's interesting, actually, as you say that, it strikes me that perhaps the thing you're pushing most against is the kind of adversarial nature of negotiation, which in a book like Getting to Yes seems to be the deficient and yet almost universal model of negotiation that the authors are pushing against. That in fact, to really take their advice seriously is to get past the adversarial nature of negotiation in seemingly the same ways that, or similar ways, perhaps, there can be adversarial kinds of undertones around a boardroom, even if everyone is quote unquote playing for the same team. There are still factions and everyone's got their hobby horse of an idea that they want to see pushed forward.
Absolutely. Having BATNA play as big a role as it does leaves you in an adversarial position. I can do this negotiation or I can default to my BATNA. I get it. And again, those guys are friends and made a huge contribution. I want to make a contribution for what it's worth in a somewhat different direction, which is to say, if we could get people to view the presence of an opposing model, right? An opposing model shows up essentially washes up on my shores. I should look at it as manna from heaven, that in that there is the seeds of a better answer. I mean, we did one. It was actually Jennifer facilitating, and she's brilliant. Jennifer Rial, my co-author, brilliant facilitator for senior staff at one of Canada's finest hospitals. And what they put on the table was the issue to work on was the vaccination debate. This is years before COVID. This was more of the challenge with the anti-vax movement on MMR, straightforward vaccination. And there were chiefs, administrative people, the chiefs of surgery, and it was a children's hospital, pediatrics, nurses, and et cetera. And one of the surgeons said, when Jennifer put this on the table, there is no vax debate. And he was like objecting to actually using this, right, as an example. That's classically what happens, right? there is no debate. The science has been determined.
We've talked about this process of pushing models to their extremes, really interrogating them to see how they work. You noted three paths to combining elements or finding different options to move forward with. So the pick and choose model, taking one element from each, doubling down on one model in some way to get a benefit that the other typically produces, and then this decomposition. And then finally, taking one permutation that comes out of each of these three pathways and testing them out and iterating before you scale.
You got it.
It's almost like I read the book, Roger.
Yeah, it's suspiciously like that.
How do these steps overcome the cognitive and social barriers that we've been talking about within organizations that typically lead to the facing world?
The key, I guess, that I found is to just make it playful. So why don't we just play around with this for a while? In that case, it was, okay, you may say the science is settled, but vaccination rates, at least in the US, are going down. Is it settled? Is this issue settled? I guess not in that sense, but we know the right answer. And we said, yeah, but why don't we just play with this for a little? Let's just suspend disbelief for a moment and say, what is the public health pro-vaccination, and how does that model work? And how does the anti-vax model work? What they came to is understanding the role of free will and choice and how the way it was being handled at that point on that, it was exacerbating the sense of free choice. I think they came to a better view as to if we actually want to tackle this, we've got to understand how people who are sensitive to the question of, do I have free voice in my children's medical care, how we've got to approach them to have a chance of this working. In that case, it was a little bit of something I kind of often do is, let's just play. How bad can this be? Now, the answer of how bad this can be is often essentially a terrification of, if I start thinking about it, maybe I will be seduced by the other side. Or by even having this conversation, I'm legitimizing the anti-vax movement. And so that's why I say, let's just play. Let's just play and see if there's anything good that comes out of this. And I say the same about strategy and about innovation. If you get too serious too fast, everybody just clams up and can't think kind of past their own nose. And if they're in a playful mood, they can. It's like getting somewhat back into a childish state.
I will note in passing for interested listeners and readers that Roger's done some really interesting work with high school age children, and I think even elementary school age children.
Yes.
I would encourage interested listeners and readers to go and hunt that down, because it really is very cool.
It's an initiative called I Think, and if you just go on and look for Rodman I Think, you will be able to find stuff on that.
As the father of a young child, I've really enjoyed going down the rabbit hole of that. But I wanted to come back to this idea of compromise. So one of the things you said in opening our conversation is that you really don't like compromise. And now that we've gone through a discussion of how the typical discursive dynamics tend to lead to these facing worlds and how we can do a little bit differently, how can we come back to this idea of compromise? How have we rehabilitated it? What is the sense of positive compromise, if such a thing exists? And do you have a word for it that you prefer so that we can get away from this thing that everybody seems to summarily hate?
I don't use compromise or negotiation. I'm looking for possibilities. Generally speaking, I just won't stop until I get a better idea. At the Rotman School, when I showed up as dean, right, for those who know my background, I was a business guy, not an academic, not a PhD. Being a dean was my first job in an academic institution ever. And I arrived and was told by the faculty, you have to decide, Roger. And they were deeply suspicious of me because I went to Harvard Business School, which is sort of the great Satan for the research-oriented, what are called the research-oriented business schools, even though Harvard Business School does more research than any other business school, but they're viewed as teaching-oriented. So it was, are you going to be teaching-oriented? Are you going to make Rodman into a teaching-oriented school or a research-oriented school? And they said, you got to choose. And they described, well, if you're teaching-oriented, yes, students might like it, but you'll never be able to hire good faculty and will never be any good. If you're research-oriented, you just have to live with the fact that students aren't going to like it very much, but you can build a great kind of research faculty and that'll make you a great school. So they had their own idea of which my answer should be. And I just said, I gave up a really, really good job and a really, really good career to do public service back in my home country. I'm literally going to start with saying, well, I want to be somewhat more teaching oriented. And it was like, yeah, shoot me now. That was kind of my reaction. I thought about it until I came up with an integrative solution. All right. And the integrative solution was one that both absolutely skyrocketed our teaching ratings and took us from nowhere in research to being ranked. I know it's hard to believe, but to being ranked third in the business school world in research behind only Harvard and Wharton, ahead of Stanford, Sloan, Columbia, Chicago, Duke, Berkeley. Unthinkable, literally unthinkable, because I wasn't willing to even contemplate compromise. We were going to be better than anybody in the entire faculty could ever believe we would be on research. Way better, not better, way better, and better at teaching than anybody could contemplate. And that's doable. So I eat my own dog food. I do it wherever I go, because life is too short for compromise.
I like that. And shifting now into the practical aspects of this, you note in the book that integrative thinking is both a solo as well as a team sport. And I think a lot of what we've talked about here already gives some of the ingredients of how individuals can get started on this. And the book, Creating Great Choices, has lots more detail and great examples to help people work through that. But for those wanting to engage in a team sport, working in a group environment and wanting to bring this practice into what it is that they're doing, where can they start? What can they do Monday morning to get the ball rolling to change the kinds of conversations they're having in their organizations?
I would say don't go looking for trouble, but if trouble finds you, right, which is you want to do X and the other person wants to do not X, I would literally start by saying, hey, can we try something here? I'd like to understand fully your model, how your model works, how it produces the outputs that you see it producing. I will do the same for mine. I'd love to start with yours, because what I want to demonstrate by working on yours is that I'm not trying to tear it down. I'm trying to understand it. So I'm going to be exceedingly positive about your model with the hopes that you will be about my mind. And then what I'd love to do is work together to see, can we get the key attributes of both of these models in one new model? Can we just try that? We won't do it for more than an hour. You know, we'll take a break then. If you're like tired, disgusted, annoyed by that time, we won't do anything more. But we'll continue if you're like saying, oh man, we're making some progress here and we might be able to come up with something. Would that be okay with you? Would that be a use of an hour that you could imagine you enjoying and having some good come from? The other person will say yes. My experience is they virtually always say yes. Then the key is to be positive about their model. Say, oh, I don't know. No, that's not real. Oh, you think that? Don't do anything about that. Say, okay, so the idea here is for the consumers, they would get this, and that's a real benefit. I do that, right? And for the company, this is what it does for our employees. All of that together gets you that. Do I have that right? You just are unfailingly kind of non-judgmental about it. You're just seeking to understand, and you don't try to do anything in terms of creative solution until you get yours out too, and say, we're going to turn to mine. So here's what I'd love to do. I'd love to ask the question. Here's how these work. What are the things we absolutely love? What are the pieces of these we love? And create the little chart with little hearts on it. There's things we love. And then say, okay, now we try to find a way to get those things in a brand new model. And generally, you come up with a brand new model, and isn't that super hard? I mean, people should do it all the time. They just don't. And they're trained not to. They're trained to fight and negotiate, not do that.
So moving a little bit in reverse order, what we talked about at the beginning of the conversation is the steps to go through. Like, here's the recipe. What you've just laid out here is here's how to create an opening with someone to get those steps going. And the last step that I want to take, the furthest step back, and this resonates with something from Creating Great Choices as well, is that you note that mindset, even personality, or even way of being in the world seems to be an important ingredient here. It's not just about knowing the process and having the skills. It's about your approach. And from the way that you describe it, your respect for other people, that you need to be able to truly believe and embrace the idea that a reasonable person can hold a different view.
Yes, and which has now disappeared in America.
I know you're down in the States now, but as a Canadian, you must know that we're not that far off up here either.
No. If you see things differently, it's because you are stupid or evil. That's the two explanations. And people say, well, though, that's pretty harsh, Roger. Well, they're just variants of stupid. They don't really understand. They haven't thought it through. That's all variants of stupid. Or they're just meanies. They don't care about these people. And they're evil. So if you have a mindset that says opposing ideas are the product of stupid or evil people, you'll be stuck, unfortunately, having a relatively miserable life. you know, I hate to put too fine a point on it, but that's the long and short of it. You will be stuck having a miserable life. If instead you can get yourself to the point of view of saying, I have a view worth hearing, but I might be missing something, then you'll have a much happier life. Because what you'll be inclined to do is put out your view to others. This is what I've thought of thus far. This is the best answer I could come up with thus far, but I might be missing something. Then it's just this very, very open and genuine invitation for you to show you what you might be missing. It's just this invitation. And people would say, Roger, you know, it's because you don't understand about leaders. Leaders can't be that vulnerable, which is, again, a model, right? I've talked about models. That's a model. Leaders are vulnerable. It's one of those interesting, fallacious models that where if you just look at leaders and how vulnerability kind of actually works, is the leaders that show vulnerability of that sort are the most beloved leaders and are the ones that people would run through a brick wall to help them. But as long as you have the view that that's vulnerable, it's just not. And the best leaders I've ever worked with of giant corporations in the public sector all have that kind of vulnerability. Way back when, a guy who runs a $100 billion plus private company is one of the richest people in the world. We were doing a study for his company, and he rarely used four-letter words. And in this meeting, he described a practice that they'd had, and it was a well thought out practice. It was in the commodities business, and it built up stores of this commodity at a certain cycle of the year because it felt that that was better. Everybody knew that he was intimately involved. This wasn't somebody else's idea. It was at least his idea as much as anybody else. And he just says, you know, we got to look at this and say, after 10 years of doing this, this ain't worth a four-letter word that starts with D. And everybody's like, he didn't kind of swear. And that's not a terrible swear word, but anyway. But did people think he's less of a CEO? No, they were like, holy smokes. He's willing to look at his own ideas and say, some of them just aren't so hot. I guess I can do that too. And that's the kind of place we have around here where you don't get shot for admitting that you had an idea that was bad. In fact, this guy just did it of his own volition. And boy, he must be committed to learning and getting to better answers, right? Whereas somebody would make, oh, well, he was very vulnerable there, and you can't be vulnerable and be a leader. He was more leaderly after he did it in the eyes of his followers than he was before it. Now, if he was wrong 90% of the time, right, they would say, you know, hey, we've got a bit of a problem here, but you wouldn't be a leader. If you're a leader, being vulnerable in that way, that's the stance. If you want to be successful in life, you should try to convince yourself to always go forward with the, I have a view worth hearing, but I might be missing something.
I really like that. And I think that that's a great note to tie things up on, coming back to the idea that taking that kind of stance is not to flip-flop. It's not to compromise. It's not to try and please everybody. But that stance is a necessary starting point to really do well all of the stuff that gets built on top that we've been discussing for the past hour about figuring out what it is that you might be missing, the partial picture that other people who disagree with you are carrying around, and how it is that you can bring together the best of those two partial pictures into something that's more complete than either one on its own.
You got it. That is it. And you see, in that little description, to me, there was no hint of either compromise or negotiation. I think you can accomplish all those things without ever delving into those two rhetorical realms.
Yeah, I really like that. Anyway, Roger, thank you very much for this discussion. It's been great.
You're welcome. It was my pleasure. It's always fun to talk to somebody who's read the book and has interesting thoughts about it. So thank you for that.
If you'd like to learn more about Applied Behavioral Insights, you can find plenty of materials on our website, thedecisionlab.com. There, you'll also be able to find our newsletter, which features the latest and greatest developments in the field, including these podcasts, as well as great public content about biases, interventions, and our project work.